This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
We will call a hearing to order. This is Chairman Nelson. This is the time and place that has been designated for a hearing on AT&T Mobility's motion for a partial summary judgment. It is 1 p.m. in room 413 of the State Capitol Building. I am present in the hearing room along with Commissioner Hansen, and Commissioner Feagin is present on the phone, so we do have a quorum. This is AT&T's motion. So, Mr. Van Camp, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bill Van Camp. I'm an attorney from Peer here on behalf of New Singular Wireless, doing business as AT&T Mobility. I'll probably refer to my client as AT&T or Mobility. I'll try to keep it straight, but sometimes I jump around. But in this matter, Venture has filed a complaint seeking to collect what they think is a past owed amount from AT&T for trunks that were ordered pursuant to access service requests that are subject to what they describe as their pricing catalog. Now, what that amounts to in real dollars is 96 trunks through four circuits. That's it, the total billing is $2,754 per circuit, as it is described by Venture. And those are located in Venture's end offices in Sisseton, Highmore, and Britton. Venture, in its complaint, lays out, and we're not arguing with this, that there was only one such circuit that was ordered in 2012, and then three new circuits were ordered in late of 2017. And I think that's where this situation arose through billing that started after those three circuits were placed into those Venture end offices. Now, it's our contention in the briefing, and as I'll state today, that their claim, Venture's claim, must fail as a matter of law for several reasons. And you can assume Venture's facts as they want to argue them, but what you can't change through argument is the plain language of the agreement between the parties through their interconnection agreement and through the amendment to that was done after 2012. And you also can't change the plain language of their tariff sheet and their pricing catalog as they self-describe it. So just for a little bit of background, I know this isn't the briefing, but Venture and Mobility's predecessor, Western Wireless, entered into a reciprocal compensation, interconnection, and transport agreement in 2004. As the Commission is certainly aware, interconnection agreements, or ICAs, are required of telecommunication carriers pursuant to Section 251 of the Act of 1996, the Telecommunication Act of 96. Local carriers must negotiate with mobile companies and other providers who wish to provide service in the areas where the LECs serve. The 2004 agreement was negotiated and settled between Western Wireless and Venture, and that was actually filed and approved by this commission, I think, in 2004. Mobility and Venture later amended their interconnection agreement, and this has been filed in the briefing and also in the docket as a whole, to reflect the 2011 FCC Connect America order. And as the Commission is certainly well aware, that order adopted a default bill and keep regimen for non-access or local traffic between LECs and wireless providers, amongst other providers as well. So how do we look at, and how does this commission look at the ICA and the amendment, which are contracts signed between the parties? Nobody's arguing the contestability or the validity of those contracts. There's no defense that the contract is invalid. When you look at the language that is put in those agreements by the parties separately negotiated prior to today, and how do we see if their claim survives? If it's clear, and that's the legal standard that I argue in my brief, if the language of a contract is clear, the duty of a court, or in this case the commission sitting in the role of a court under the rules of South Dakota civil procedure, has a duty to declare the contract and enforce it. You know, the search for the truth is at the end if it's found in the plain language of the contract. Okay? So 5.1 of the interconnection agreement states, Mobility, substituting for Western Wireless because this is the original agreement, and Venture shall reciprocally and symmetrically compensate one another for local traffic that terminates on either party's network. It sets a price in the 2004 agreement pursuant to an appendix, but that's no longer relevant because the amendment that went into effect 7-1 of 2012 states, and this is term one of the agreement, all non-access traffic between the parties shall be exchanged on a bill and keep basis. Okay, and what's the basis of reciprocal compensation agreements? Okay, whatever terminates on our network will pay what they pay to terminate on their network, right? It's an equal footing. That's the intent of the entire regimen that was created and which was adopted by the ICA amendment. Now, AT&T doesn't directly connect with its facilities to Venture at its end offices. AT&T, and this hasn't been disputed in any of the filings, sends its end-user traffic to SDN. And under 4.3 of the ICA, Section 4.3, SDN then delivers that traffic to Venture for termination. We pay SDN, AT&T does, under that agreement. Calls that go the other way happen when an end-user of Venture's calls an AT&T number. It goes to Venture's end offices. It hits the facilities that AT&T has purchased from SDN, traverses those facilities. AT&T pays a transportation cost to SDN, and it's delivered to AT&T's network. Okay, and as we asserted, and as is allowed under the agreement section 4.3, it's clearly been contemplated by the parties that there will be a third party that provides those network elements for the calls in question. And we discovered in a filing last night by Venture that, as we had claimed, Venture is compensated by SDN for that transportation service, for those calls that are routed through the SDN facilities to Venture's end offices, where they are, well, in reverse, through SDN's facilities to AT&T's facilities. Now, assuming, as Venture claims, that the trunks are necessary for its end users, and I'm not arguing this fact, and under summary judgment you have to assume it, that, and I think we even asserted as well, that those facilities provided by Venture are necessary for Venture's customers, not AT&T's customers, but Venture's customers to make seven-digit dialing calls, right, in the area of each of those end offices without having to make a toll call. Compensation still wouldn't, we believe, be warranted for those facilities under the ICA and the agreement. Reciprocal and symmetrical charges for delivery to each other's end users is what is required under those agreements. The ICA language is clear, and under the summary judgment standard that's been articulated, this commission, acting in the role of a court, has to declare the plain language of the ICA and its amendment and declare that we don't have to pay compensation for those calls. Now, leaving that aside, and I think moving on to again what was their argument in opposition to the summary judgment, they move off of that and don't want to discuss the nature of the traffic. And they move to a price catalog for these trunks, leaving aside the reciprocal responsibility under the ICA and the amendment to deliver each other's traffic, which is 251, which is the Telecom Act of 96. And they move to a pricing catalog and a charge of $98.50 for each cellular digital trunk. Now, the trouble with that is their own tariff language, where the catalog is located, defines a trunk as a circuit over which customers' messages are sent between two central offices, which I don't believe is happening here. I think that's the service that SDN provides. Or between a central office and a private branch exchange system, which I don't think is relevant here. So I think, to sum this up, Venture is attempting to collect on something that doesn't meet their own definition of what a trunk is. Their customers connect at their end office, where they are then connected to SDN's DS1 circuits that were ordered by AT&T and paid for by AT&T In reality, as we argue in our filing, what Venture is providing is a port or a service similar to an end-of-office switching agreement arrangement that they may be compensable for, but it's not for transportation trunks, as they attempt to assert under their pricing schedule. That's not the service we believe they're providing. Now, the estate of lien in our filings, the law in South Dakota is that interpretation of written documents are particularly appropriate for dissolution by summary judgment. Summary judgment, though it doesn't occur very often in this commission, is not necessarily something that's frowned upon. If the language is clear, and if they're attempting to receive compensation for a service that is provided by SDN and not by Venture, if it's an end-office-only function, I would argue they aren't entitled to compensation under the original 2004 agreement or the ICA. Reciprocal symmetrical compensation, it's what required. Bill and keep for non-access traffic, that's required. Again, I think SDN is providing the transport under 4.3 of the ICA as is contemplated between the parties. By its own pricing catalog and definition, I think Venture's at where they're at. I understand that with a company, the nature of which is my client, sometimes these payments occur and it takes a number of time or a number of months or even years for these disputes to work their way through. And you've seen that in the filing and in the complaint and the answer, that it was elevated between the companies. They weren't able to resolve it. And so now Venture is here asking for the commission. Not today. This isn't a hearing. Sorry, Commissioner Nelson. I was going down the road we agreed we weren't going to go down. But they are asking for this to proceed to allow them to collect under the ICA and under their tariff sheet, I would think, more than the ICA. And I think as a matter of law and as a matter of strict contract interpretation and compliance, they're not able to recover for the nature of these calls, which is clearly provided by another provider. Thank you.
We're going to have questions at the end, but and I've got more questions, but I want to ask just a couple based on something you said before we go any further. So even though this traffic is going out to SDN and coming back, you're contending that it is all local traffic. Is that correct?
I think there's the possibility. I mean, we get into the old PIU determinations. I think there's a possibility that there's a compensable amount that is not local within the MTA. How we define that and what that amount is, I don't know. But on their claim as it sits, they haven't pled that, Commissioner Nelson. And they're pleading for the entire 2,754 times 4.
I understand. I just want to know what you were considering it.
I suspect that, and I think that's in some of our pleadings, that there is likely some calls that would qualify as interstate in nature. Okay, and that could be compensable. But I think the minutes of use are de minimis at best.
Second question. So you're not disputing that AT&T ordered these D0... Can't call them trunks because you're claiming they're not trunks.
That's fair.
But D0, if they're not trunks, what are they?
I think in this instance, as we've alleged, those provide a port function. The D0 doesn't connect to anywhere outside of their end office. The DS1 ordered from SDN is the trunk that delivers the call directly to AT&T's network. This is, and this gets back to your earlier question, because now it's kind of tripping me. Those calls, the only functionality of those DSO ports is to provide 7-digit dialing. You know, so a call to a local AT&T mobility customer who is in the district. Now, what I believe, if I remember from the pleadings, or maybe it's in the filings, there's roaming. So I can dial, in my case, being in Pier, 280, and it might hit my cell phone while I'm on vacation in Pier. I haven't entered 605, right? I've just entered 280, but there's a roaming there. So that's always a possibility, but I think the vast bulk and the majority of these calls are local.
Thank you. Venture.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you. My name for the record.
And if you would punch that, there we go.
Yeah, sorry. My name for the record is Ben Dickens with the firm of Bluestone, Mordkovsky, et cetera, in Washington, D.C. And I'm appearing for Venture Communications today along with my co-counsel, Ms. Rogers, from here in Pierre. Let me try to rephrase what I was going to say in light of Mr. Van Camp's argument. The critical thing about this interconnection agreement and the amendment that Mr. Van Camp mentioned is that the traffic that's subject to bill and keep is transport and termination. Termination has a very specific definition in the FCC's rules. It means that the carrier to whom the traffic is being delivered switches that traffic and delivers it to the end user. That is a very critical part of this discussion. The other part of the discussion is the nature of the traffic. We very much believe the nature of the traffic is critical to our complaint and to AT&T's defense, and hence this motion today. The traffic is originating. These trunks that AT&T ordered are not necessary for interconnection itself. AT&T ordered them so their customers could get dialed on a seven-digit basis by Venture's customers. It's not an Elon Musk-era exercise by AT&T. There's a commercial reason for that. So Venture fulfilled the order the orders that AT&T gave them for these ASRs, and provisioned the circuits. AT&T tested these circuits, and they used them for years before they disputed the charges. Now, I accept Mr. Van Camp's assertion at face value. Sometimes it takes AT&T years to figure out what's going on, and that's indeed what happened here. And I suppose it could happen to any large carrier. But in any event, the factual dispute here is significant because AT&T argues two things. It argues that these DSO circuits are covered by the bill and keep requirement that only applies to terminating traffic. And you can look in the ICA amendment that Mr. Van Camp mentioned at paragraph 3. It's black and white. And you can look at the FCC's definition of terminating traffic. That's section 51.701B2 of the FCC's rules. But in any event, the nature of the traffic is critical. This is originating traffic. Venture's chief witness, Mr. John Drew, I believe, is on the telephone with us today, has covered this in his testimony. The ASRs that AT&T filled out are appended to his testimony. They'll be in the record when the hearing comes around. And you'll be able to question them at length, which I encourage you to do. But in any event, those ASRs show that AT&T filled out the seven-digit numbers that they want their subscribers to be called locally in these originating calls from Venture's customers. Okay, they filled out the percent interstate usage that Mr. Van Camp mentioned is zero. So there are no interstate calls according to AT&T, which is, as an interesting side note, one of their affirmative defenses is you don't have jurisdiction because this is an interstate matter. I don't get it. But anyway, so it's clear that this is local traffic originating in nature, and it's not in any way terminating traffic. It's not traffic that's not subject to your jurisdiction. In any event, excuse me a second. AT&T makes a related claim that indeed this traffic is covered by tariffs. The agreement itself defines this traffic as non-access, which is pretty much diametrically opposed to the concept that this is access traffic covered by access tariffs, either NECA or LECA, whichever one it is. And so there's a fair amount of testimony in the record on that, which is indeed another factual dispute. And I guess boiled down to it, I thought Mr. Van Camp did a nice job in his motion of discussing the law of summary judgment, which is that if there is a genuine factual dispute, summary judgment is not proper. And indeed, it's a heavy lift. I found a couple other cases that I cited in our papers in response to the motion that says it's an extreme remedy and a drastic remedy. Those are words of the South Dakota Supreme Court to impose on a non-movement, which is us, since we're not moving for summary judgment. So I would say to you that there's plenty of factual record here to conclude that that summary judgment is not proper. The traffic itself is originating traffic. It doesn't qualify for summary judgment. The catalog itself is the only place AT&T could order this service. It doesn't appear in the LECA tariff. It doesn't appear in the NECA tariff. They had to get it out of the LECA price list, excuse me, the venture price list. And I think that we explained in the pre-file testimony of Mr. John Drow where that price list came from. These used to be tariffs that were filed with the commission, local tariffs that were filed with the commission some time ago. And it may have been caught up in that statutory amendments a long time ago when the legislature created fully competitive and emerging competitive and I can't remember the other category. But I think it was part of, in that mix when these tariffs were de-tariffed and then it became a local pricing catalog instead of a tariff. In any event, I think those are all the points I wanted to make in my opening remarks. So I wanted to mention this port function too. AT&T witness, I think it's Lee, had argued that at the end of the day, all this goes out of one port, and that port is covered by bill and keep. There's no support for that anywhere in his testimony. And we actually pointed out in our motion, or excuse me, our response to the motion, and still didn't get it. There's no basis for that anywhere. It's not in the FCC orders. It's not in the interconnection agreements. So Mr. John Drow will testify to that as well, and he'll tell you where the other ports are that terminate traffic and are subject to bill and keep that Venture has, but not that one, which is where these DSO circuits are routed. So in any event, I think that the main message that I have for you today is that there is a very valid factual dispute. It's not contrived. The facts in this case were submitted to the commission chiefly in our complaint and our reply. We were not anticipating a motion for summary judgment from AT&T. We weren't monkeying around with the facts. These are the facts that support our claim that we're owed money and that AT&T is not paying us. And it's, so therefore, I would submit to you it's a very valid factual dispute. And if there are any doubts at all, I don't think there are, of course, but if there were any doubts at all, they get construed in our favor according to the South Dakota summary judgment standards. And therefore, AT&T's summary judgment motion should be denied. And I'm glad to answer any questions if I could.
Thank you. We will go to staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Amanda Reese for staff. Staff did not file a position on the motion for summary judgment. After reading the briefs, it was staff's position that the parties adequately laid out the legal standard as well as the potential issues, whether this is a contract interpretation or whether this is a decision on the facts for access versus non-access. And we think the parties are best suited to answer technical questions from the commission on this today. Thank you.
You don't want to get in the mix.
No, thank you.
Mr. Van Camp, rebuttal.
As I stated at the beginning of my argument, there may be facts in dispute about some of the nature of what is claimed by Venture versus what is claimed by AT&T. But at the end, facts in dispute are not enough to forestall summary judgment if the agreement of the parties is clear. I'll point out that they can include language from their tariff as they see fit in their pricing sheet, but then they shouldn't be able to walk away from their own definition of what is a trunk and how it's provided. I found that rather an interesting argument. As to the nature of the traffic itself, I think it's clear. It's not been contested that the traffic isn't delivered from AT&T's facilities by SDN to the Venture End office. So this is simply an attempt to foist another charge on AT&T for minimal traffic. And we think that under the agreements of the parties, that effort should not be successful as a matter of law and contract interpretation.
Thank you. We will now go to questions from the commissioners. And Commissioner Feagin, I'll let you go first.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. So when I have read everything, to me, of course, the facts are not clear. And until I have the opportunity to talk to some experts and be able to question them, it's a real difficult to make a decision today. This question, of course, is a little different, and I'm sorry to ask this. I know Commissioner Nelson spends a lot of time on telecom nationally, and he really represents South Dakota well at a lot of national type of telecom discussions and task forces and et cetera. I work more on transmission lines. So although we're not asking about this today, help me understand the 10-digit dialing and how that mandate in the future in October or next July or whenever, how will that change all of this discussion, not on judgment, but how will that change? And if AT&T, you could answer that, and if then Venture wants to answer that, that's fine. And I'm just asking because I don't work in telecom.
Commissioner Feagin, it's my understanding from my client that this is a self-correcting problem as of next year. Now, that there might be some of those ports that we would consider or a business reason for some of those facilities to still remain there. I don't know that, but it doesn't change the nature of what those are. But, right, we are going to 10-digit required dialing. Whether we like it or not, I still like the 4-digit dialing I grew up with in Pier.
And those party lines, right? You probably didn't have party lines in Pier like you did in rural Turner County. Venture, do you have anything to add to that question on 10-digit dialing?
I apologize. I missed the first part of the question. If you don't mind, could you repeat it for me?
The question is a little bit about the future on 10-digit dialing. And
okay.
Although that's not part of this complaint, what does this look like in a year from now when 10-digit dialing is mandated in July or October or whenever that is?
Well, I actually was discussing that with my co-counsel earlier today, and I think that there are ways for the industry to treat certain 10-digit dialed numbers as local calls still. And the reason I say that is I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and we have 10-digit dialing there. And it's has something to do with area code exhaust, I believe. But when I dial 703-836-6328, which is the telephone number of my butcher down the street, it goes through as a local call. And so I think the industry will be able to manage that without a great deal of trouble. The people that are really going to be impacted by this are, in today's parlance, we might call them edge providers, but they're folks like the security industry. You have a panel in your home that is currently programmed to dial 7 digits. Sometimes, to get to an alarm monitoring center. Same thing with medical alert companies. And now they're going to have to send trucks out. And for some of these larger companies, there'll be millions of truck rolls to get these panels reprogrammed. And I think those are the guys that will feel a big impact from this.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Nelson, I really don't have any other questions today. Thank you.
Commissioner Hansen.
I have several questions, but they're based upon the statements that were made, and I think that Mr. Van Camp articulated some good positions, but I need to compare those with the recompare those to the contracts again. And I know that we rarely bench something at this juncture, but I think that also that Venture has made some compelling arguments, notwithstanding the what I have to check on, that they that there are actually items that need to be further examined in a hearing. So I'm betwixt those two places at this time. I need to do some. I don't feel I can vote on this until I've read some information. So I'm going to listen to additional discussion and see whether I can reach that.
Thank you. I'm going to ask each side a couple of questions, and I will readily admit we might be getting a little far afield for the purpose of which we are here today, but it's going to help me solidify in my mind. Mr. Van Camp, if you would refer to Venture Communications' reply and memorandum in support of its opposition. You can find that document. And looking at the bottom of page 4, top of page 5, so that last paragraph on page 4 and then the first paragraph on page 5, if you could maybe just walk through that and tell me where you disagree with what Venture is claiming here.
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about the last sentence that begins instead?
No, the last sentence that begins the last paragraph.
Oh, okay.
It begins, thus Venture disputes.
If you'd give me one moment.
Absolutely, yeah. Just tell me where Venture is wrong in this.
I think that the argument that is made there by Venture still doesn't get over the hurdle of the reciprocal compensation requirement under the 2004 original agreement. The parties have a responsibility under the 96 Act to deliver each other's traffic on a reciprocal and what's my favorite word that I have a hard time pronouncing? Symmetrical basis. And so the need for certain individuals to utilize seven-digit dialing or to have that availability is a need, and we're not arguing that they're not owed something for that. We're arguing that under the agreements and under their own definition here, which are two separate arguments, that it's not, in fact, a trunk for the delivery of that service under the ICA. That's what we're buying from SDN under Section 4.3 of the ICA.
And so the distinction between originating and terminating traffic, you're telling me that that's really irrelevant here. Is that correct?
Well, if I understood Mr. Dickens' argument earlier, I think he said the door swings both ways on the seven-digit dialing. And I think that the party's reciprocal compensation requirement swings both ways.
And so, therefore, the argument is irrelevant.
I think that the argument is irrelevant. And if I misquoted Mr. Dickens, I apologize, but I believe he did say that, that it allows both sides to use seven-digit dialing.
Okay, I see puzzled looks. I'll give you a chance to weigh in.
I think I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. I said, if I said that both sides can use seven-digit dialing, it's an originating service. Can you tell me what? I'm a little confused about what you heard from me.
And probably don't want to go back and forth in a summary judgment motion, but I think that the point of the paragraph that you identified and asked me the question about, Commissioner, was that the facilities were for Ventures customers to use a seven-digit dialing capability to reach Mobility's customers in the region. And I thought Mr. Dickens referenced that it goes both ways, that a Mobility customer uses the same facilities. Now, I don't know if that's factually true. If I'm an AT&T customer and I dial, I'm still going to come through the SDN pipe, as I understand it.
I don't think I said that. If I did, I apologize.
Okay.
Because
And frankly, that part's probably not relevant to what I was trying to get at, so we'll just let that go for the moment. I appreciate your answers. So for Venture, and I'm looking at AT&T Mobility's Statement of Undisputed Material Facts, if you could find that document.
Okay.
Looking at number four, paragraph four, what is not true about that paragraph?
I would say the statement is overbroad. The SDN, we just learned this, by the way, a few days ago. We were doing some diligence before the hearing, I think it was last Friday, and we discovered and Venture's records that there were some payments from SDN to Venture for those three DS1 facilities that are the subject of AT&T's focus in this. So we took a look at what those were, and they appear to be payments for channel terminations that Venture provides for those circuits. Okay, I would respectfully suggest that's irrelevant. There was a discovery question on this, which we interpreted to mean was Venture getting paid by SDN for those DSO facilities that are the subject of our complaint, the facilities that provide seven-digit dialing.
That's not what this paragraph talks about. So I'm asking you.
I know, but it's in his motion for summary.
Yeah, but that's not what I asked. My question was, what do you believe is not true about this paragraph?
Okay. Well, first, I don't think that Venture is the agent of SDN for anything in this. Venture provides the end of the
service. And this does not talk about Venture being an agent.
Mobility compensates SDN to act as the agent for Mobility in the delivery of the delivery of traffic to Venture's end users. Oh, I'm sorry, I misread it. SDN acts as the agent for Mobility.
Did you
have the mic closer to you there? Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chairman. I have no knowledge as to whether they're compensating SDN to be an agent or not.
Okay, so you don't know that it may be true.
Could be, yes.
Okay. So let's look at paragraph 5. And I'll ask the same question. What do you believe is not true about this statement?
what I would say is that the statement is incomplete.
So I'm chuckling because the comment that I wrote here is probably incomplete. So verbatim.
I'm glad to know I'm on your wavelength today. But in any event, yes, the venture provides the ability in the switch to convert or to allow these calls to be to allow the NXXs identified by AT&T to be called on a local 7-digit basis. It does multiplexing inside that switch that's not mentioned in this sentence, and it hands off the call to AT&T on the other side of the switch once it's completed. That's my understanding.
So there really isn't anything that's incorrect here, but it's incomplete. Is that accurate?
I would say that's accurate, subject to Mr. Gendreau correcting me if we get to the hearing. Yes.
Okay. I think that's all the questions I've got. Those are just some areas that I wanted to try to clarify, if I could, in my mind. Any further commissioner questions? Anything either side would like to clarify based on commissioner questions?
No, Mr. Chairman.
No.
Is there a motion in this regard?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm hearing some quiet there, so I'm taking the opportunity to move in CT20-001. I move to deny the motion for partial summary judgment.
Discussion on the motion.
First of all, this is a very technical and detailed complaint and filing, and something that the commission doesn't see every single day. I am more comfortable having experts at the table and at the hearing to make sure that I can make a record that is complete when I make my final decision. The facts and the evidence are in dispute. And as a commissioner, and of course state law, until I can make sure that the facts and evidence are accurate in an evidentiary hearing, I'm uncomfortable in supporting even a partial summary judgment. So if this passes today, my motion, I look forward to being able to visit with the experts and making sure that we get the record correct and get the decision correct. Thank you.
Additional discussion. Well, obviously, one of the criteria, one of the chief criteria in this type of motion is whether the facts are in dispute. And certainly reading through the briefs of both sides, I was left with the conclusion that they are in dispute. And that hasn't been cleared up by anything that's been presented today. In fact, based on some of my, questioning, maybe everything is not completely clear by the attorneys without having the actual witnesses here to present. It is a complicated matter, obviously. If it was simple, you two would have been able to work this out prior to getting here, but it's not, obviously. And so because of that, I am going to support Commissioner Feagin's motion today. Additional discussion.
Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the comments by both of my commissioners. I think the attorneys both did their job today very well. Mr. Van Camp presented a very articulate, thought-provoking, and compelling. As I was looking at my position from reading the materials and everything prior to this, I was leaning strongly towards denying move for partial summary judgment, And I'd say that Venture Communications, Ben Company, did an excellent job of what attorneys do best is confusing the issue and presenting the information. And it's very true. Our job is, if facts are in dispute, then we cannot judge and we cannot provide a summary judgment. So that's where I am. I'm hoping this was recorded. I believe it was, so that I can go back and listen to it again. I want to check some of the items that were presented and see where I am, and then we're going to end up in a hearing anyway, and I imagine we're going to hear the similar discussions, only with some evidence presented to us. And as much as I don't particularly care to to do that, that's where I am. So I'm going to support the motion as well.
Thank you. Further discussion, and I will just add, Commissioner Hansen, I am greatly looking forward to this hearing. Additional discussion. Hearing none. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. The motion is denied. Anything else for the good of the order? Yes, Karen.
I just have a question of the parties. So the title on this, I just need to know if AT&T wants it to read differently, the caption on it. Did you want it is in the matter of the complaint of Venture Communications Cooperative against AT&T Mobility. Did you need that changed in any manner to reflect?
Correct entity is how I identify it, as I understand it, which is New Singularity Wireless doing business as.
Right. So should we just modify that?
If there's no objection from Venture.
I just have it corrected. Okay. I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I understand that we're going to be celebrating every week this year, the 45th year of Greg Reslow. So happy anniversary and a week, so 45 years and 1 week, for being a Public Utilities Commissioner staff member.
It is the month of Reslow, yes.
This needs to end soon, I'm afraid. I like it here, so, you know, I don't want to have expectations being too high. It's not fair.
Bringing me to tears.
I think with that, I will declare the hearing adjourned.